This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
Well, it's no secret that plastic waste is everywhere. Plastic pollution, unfortunately, is everywhere, too. In fact, it has become one of the most important and foremost environmental issues that are affecting ecosystems and communities everywhere, including Northwest Indiana. And we have a new study from Valparaiso University with one of our guests coming up to talk about the research that's been done into it and how it has seemed to have affected Porter County. We are talking today with Valparaiso University Environmental Chemistry Professor Julie Peller, along with Ron Taylor. He is the Public Education Coordinator for the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District. And Ron and Professor Peller, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, Professor Peller, I'll let you lead things off. Your study with your research team of environmental chemistry students looking into, I guess, measuring and categorizing plastic waste that seems to have gotten into the Porter County environment. Tell us what prompted you and your team to get to work on such a project. Where'd you go to find all this plastic waste that's out there and some of the problems that apparently Porter County is dealing with?
Yeah, I think this is widespread, as you mentioned. Really what sort of initiated this idea for work with my environmental chemistry class this past semester was my own personal experiences with having some both dirt delivered to my house and retrieving dirt from the compost pile that Porter County has available. And I've been researching plastics, especially microplastics, for the last several years, so I guess my eye is a little bit more cued into it than the average person. Mm-hmm. But I was just shocked at how many tiny little plastic waste particles were part of the dirt that was delivered by a company and also by what I found at the compost pile. So I decided to look into this a little bit more and create a project for my students. And one of the first things that I did was to literally take a tour at the compost area and look into what materials were mostly used to create that compost, and found out that by and large it was the leaf collection, and people leave their leaves at the edge of their properties. Usually right along the street area, so it seemed to me there was definitely a connection between what kind of plastic waste is out in our street area, our communities, and what ends up in the compost pile. So while our leaves nicely break down into the soil that we all like to put into our gardens, all that plastic does not. We know that it does not biodegrade, and therefore, we're seeing that from year to year, there's more of it out there simply because it continues to accumulate. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the reason behind initiating this project. And so literally last January, I sent my students out in pairs and said, go out in the community and, find the waste along the street. And of course, most of it's plastic, but I said, pick up what you have. They took a bucket, came back, and we started categories and that. We took samples from the compost pile and analyzed both of the samples and made some comparisons there.
What types of plastics did you and your research team find, I guess, among all the various types? I know that we look at typically the codes are 1 to 7. That's what most recyclable plastic, at least it comes in as. What did you find that you found out there? What were seemed to be the most abundant variety of plastics that you all collected?
Not surprising. We found that most of it was of the packaging type of plastic. We have so much of this one-use plastic that's part of our everyday life. And a lot of it just, whether we want it to or not, it just doesn't necessarily make it into the waste stream as it's supposed to, whether it's into the garbage or into the recycling. This is lightweight material that kind of takes off into our environment, and there's just a lot of it out there, a lot of that packaging type of plastic.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ron Taylor, are you finding in the collections that come in through the recyclers that provide support for the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District, that this is the type of plastic that seems to be the most prevalent that's out there, not only the containers that the contractors pick up, but you're finding out there at the drop-off sites?
I can't speak necessarily to which recycling code most of the plastic falls into, but obviously particularly the single-use plastics pose a pretty serious problem for recycling streams. Those are the ones that are not typically very suitable to be turned into new materials over and over again. They're not suitable for curbside bins or drop-off recycling. So those pose a very serious problem for recycling programs.
Now, Dr. Peller, are you finding that in the collections and the analysis that you all did within the project that we have this issue of single-use plastics, I guess is what it's called, and this is obviously what you're finding in the compost. I guess it's not supposed to be there, getting mixed in with all the compostable materials. Are we finding that this is just something that we, at least you feel, that have to be more diligent and make sure that it doesn't get mixed in to begin with?
Yeah, I think, as you mentioned, This is a huge environmental problem, and I think that there are many facets of the solution that we need to address, and certainly this is one of them. When I did take the tour at the Porter County site last winter, I was informed that they actually had people that worked along where the composting takes place to pull out a lot of the big pieces of plastic, so there is some effort to remove that from the compost, and that's good to know, but the bottom line is we still find quite a bit of it in there, and it really is just polluting that type of environment.
Fortunately, if you've ever been to the compost site, you can actually see it is a major undertaking that our staff does work at to remove, you know, the chunks of plastic from the materials that are brought in.
Well, it sounds like there's obviously a lot more than you want to begin with. Shouldn't have any at all. That's that would be the ideal. But apparently it's a case of these just things that end up in the compost because people happen to sweep them off to the side of the road. And, of course, the machinery come by and pick up the leaves or whatever other material that would go to the compost site.
Right, right. So, you know, when, you know, leaves, stuff that's just, you know, blown into the street, unfortunately, when that stuff gets picked up, when it's, you know, transported, you get all kinds of materials that you do not want in your compost. You don't want out in the environment. Unfortunately, that all can get kind of concentrated when it's all brought to the compost site.
Mm-hmm. Now, Professor,
and again, you know, our staff works very hard to get, you know, the big chunks of it, the big visible chunks. But unfortunately, as Julie stated, the problem with the plastic is that it doesn't biodegrade, but it breaks down into these progressively tinier and tinier pieces that are very difficult to get out of the environment, not impossible.
And I guess we're at the point, though, now not only are we supposed to really be recycling as we can, but we're also trying to reduce the amount of waste that we throw out, but also kind of rethinking and reusing what we are tossing out. Do you think that these are the guidelines that we need to follow these days to try to keep the plastic not only out of the waste stream, but also out of the compost piles?
Yeah, so we really try to emphasize reducing and reusing simply because, you know, recycling, what we traditionally think of as recycling and like what goes in your curbside bin, that is a very, very important piece of the puzzle, but it's just one small part of the overall effort we have to undertake to try to tackle plastic pollution. Recycling, as we've seen recently, unfortunately can be dependent on things like international markets, what other countries are doing. That can sometimes stymie our efforts to have really broad recycling programs and can be very dependent on things that we don't always have control over as a local community. Reducing and reusing, that involves behaviors and activities that are a little more under our control as households, as a local community. We can make decisions to, for example, simply buy less plastic, avoid those single-use plastics, things like plastic forks and spoons and drink cups that are not recyclable. We can make decisions that are much more under our control to avoid purchasing those kinds of things in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that's where the reducing and reusing comes in to sort of supplement the recycling that we do.
Now, Professor Peller, you've gotten this project with your students in environmental chemistry off and running, and you've gotten some results from this. Might there be any other projects related to this coming up in some of the future classes?
Definitely, and I'd like to also mention that it was interesting viewing this problem through the eyes of my students who are living in a different generation. They're much younger than me, so what they've experienced has just been normal to them. And so I think part of the problem, as Ron mentioned, we all have to recognize how much plastic we use and recognize that when we see it on the street, that's not good. It's going to end up somewhere in our environment if we're not cleaning this up and if we're not paying attention. And sometimes when I talk to young people, my concern is that that's just normal for them, seeing all this garbage that's out there. Seeing plastic bottles, plastic bags flying in the wind, stuff in bushes and trees, that this has become normal for them. And that's something we need to work on to create an understanding that this is not normal and this is harmful to our environment. As I mentioned, my research has been exploring more of the microplastics.
Mm-hmm.
And recently got some funding through the National Science Foundation and working with a colleague and collaborator at California State University, and we're using radiation techniques to study how this plastic weathers over time. We know that it's not biodegradable, but it does undergo, some very, very... There's small changes over a very long time. So over the course of decades, we're finding that the plastic does start conforming a little. It doesn't go away, but it's undergoing some changes. And so that's kind of what is on the horizon for the work that I'm doing with most of my research students at this point.
Julie Peller is a professor of environmental chemistry at Valparaiso University, and she and her students February of this year did a research project finding out more about the plastic waste that somehow or another has found its way into Porter County's environment. And Ron Taylor is the public education coordinator for the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District. He's been working, of course, to do the best as the other staffers at the district to keep the plastics that can be recycled to go to the proper places and try and keep it out of the composting pile. And thank you both for being with us here to talk about this topic today.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
And along those same lines, the topic of recycling and plastic recycling options came up recently at edition of Morning Edition.
I have this question all the time. Can I recycle this container or this bottle? So like everyone else, I flip over the container or the bottle and I look for the little triangle of arrows with the numbers inside and I think, okay, all good. Is it though? NPR's Laura Sullivan, PBS Frontline, and Planet Money looked into those symbols and found out they are not actually about recycling.
The thing about opening boxes of old records is you never know what you're going to find. I started with the plastic industry's archives at Syracuse University and the Hagley Library in Delaware. And out came cellophane and plastic wrap and styrofoam, the first products of a chemical marvel that changed the world, a product that looked like glass but didn't break. But there was another story in the boxes. Starting as early as the 1970s, the industry had a problem. All this new plastic was creating too much trash, and people didn't like it.
The feeling was the plastics industry is almost under fire. We got to do what it takes to take the heat off because we want to continue to make plastic products.
That's Larry Thomas. I found his name inside some of the files and tracked him down in retirement off the coast of Florida. Thomas was the top lobbyist for the industry for more than a decade. He was president of the Society of the Plastics Industry. And in one of the files, he writes this letter to top officials at Exxon, Chevron, Amoco, Dow, DuPont, Procter & Gamble, and others in December 1989. The image of plastics is deteriorating at an alarming rate, he writes. We are approaching a point of no return. The obvious answer to the problem of plastic trash was to recycle all of it. But the documents are full of reports telling top executives it won't work. One report from April 1973 calls recycling plastic costly, sorting it infeasible, before adding plastic degrades every time you try to reuse it. Thomas says he and the other executives knew that too.
There was a lot of discussion about how difficult it was to recycle. They knew that the infrastructure wasn't there to really have recycling amount to a whole lot.
Sure, you can physically do it, but these industry documents are saying it's time-consuming, it's expensive, chemically problematic. And because plastic is made out of oil, and oil is cheap, recycling basically doesn't make any economic sense. So recycling all the plastic wasn't going to work. They needed another solution. There were meetings, and Thomas had this colleague, Lou Freeman, who was a vice president at the Society of the Plastics Industry, and he went to them.
The basic question on the table was, you guys, as our trade association and the plastics industry, aren't doing enough. We need to do more. I remember this. This is one of these exchanges that sticks with me 35 years later, or however long it's been. And it was, what we need to do is advertise our way out of it. That was the idea thrown out.
Presenting the possibilities of plastics. Plastics
helps save. And so began the industry's $50 million a year ad campaign in the 1990s, promoting the benefits of plastic. These were iconic commercials paired with feel-good recycling contests, nonprofits, and sorting machines that didn't make any economic sense. And quietly, at the same time, the industry turned to the containers. Documents show officials lobbied almost 40 states to put the international recycling symbol on the bottom of all plastic, even if there was no way to economically recycle it. Industry officials told NPR the symbols were only meant to help sort plastic. But the symbols and the ads and the PR campaigns all touted the same recycling message. Thomas says it all made the public feel good about plastic.
If the public thinks the recycling is working, then they're not going to be as concerned about the environment.
A half dozen other former top officials told me the same thing. And some of them did have hope that maybe plastic recycling would work itself out. But 30 years later, less than 10% of all plastic has ever been recycled. The industry is now facing a crisis much like the 1990s, and top officials are once again promising to make recycling work. The industry is spending hundreds of millions on new programs. And once again, they're also spending money on new ads, telling people to recycle. The question this time, though, is whether the public will still believe them. Laura Sullivan, NPR News.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The YWCA of Northwest Indiana is celebrating its 100th birthday, or anniversary, however you wish to put it. And they are doing so with a big gala coming up here later this month. Let's find out about not only the gala, but also the event itself, the 100th anniversary of the creation of the YWCA in Northwest Indiana. And for the person who's done all the research and tell us more about it, we turn to Karen Jones. She's Executive Director of the YWCA of Northwest Indiana, based in Gary. Thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate you having me today we could talk about our 100th anniversary, which we are really excited about.
Well, the event for the gala is coming up later this month, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But let's focus for a moment here now, if we will, Karen, on the creation of the YWCA in Northwest Indiana, which was in Gary. The research that you did, some time back about this, what did you learn about the creation of the YW? And maybe even why it's still around and there's no YMCA, so to speak, of in Northwest Indiana today.
Well, what I found out was that 100 years ago in 1920, the mayor at the time, Mayor William Hodges, whose wife, whose name is Cassie Hodges, she wanted to start a YWCA for the women in Gary at that time, which the city was relatively new, founded in 1906. They had already had a YMCA for men, but there wasn't anything for the women. So she and a group of other women got together and decided that that's what they would do, but they needed funding. So they decided to go to New York to see the U.S. Steel CEO, which the city is named after, Albert H. Gary, and Mr. Gary decided to give them the funding that they needed to start the YWCA here in Gary. and that's how it all gets started.
Now, we note that since the YWCA in Northwest Indiana in Gary opened in 1920, that was around the same time as another pandemic was just ending, and that's, of course, the one that was following World War One, the Spanish flu. Is it maybe ironic that it should happen that the 100th anniversary should be at the end of, another pandemic?
Wow, who would have thought that could have happened all over again? I mean, you talk about nostalgia, but being that we're in it now, we had other plans, but with that, we will have to go virtual mm-hmm. for our gala for this year. So we have to do what we have to do. So we're having a virtual gala this year.
Well, certainly you're not letting 100 years and the milestone of that be disrupted by something as trivial as a pandemic, right?
Oh, of course not. So we're going to have a virtual masquerade gala October the 31st, which, of course, is Halloween also, but mm-hmm. that's our day, too. So we got masks and we got masks. So we're going to be doing it from Majestic Star Casino in their pavilion. We're going to live stream. Of course, we're going to do all of our, social distancing and, everything else that we're supposed to be doing. But we're going to have a special guest host. Will be Samantha Chapman from ABC 7 News, and with co-hosting with her dad, who's a DJ radio personality out of Chicago, Sam Chapman. Mm-hmm. And we'll have, silent auction, we'll have dancing, and we're going to take a stroll down memory lane.
I know one of the other things that you've all been working very hard on, and in particular after the fact that with the pandemic closed everything down, including the YWCA of Northwest Indiana, you got a chance during the summer months to reopen. But I know you've been very, very busy not only in getting things together, in following all the procedures, the safety procedures and all, to be able to let people come back into the YW, but you've also been trying to get things together for, I guess, a building improvements and program support campaign, I guess is the best way to describe it.
Sure.
Will you tell us about it and what your goals are for it?
We are having a capital campaign. This is basically the kickoff for it. We want to start off with $100,000. We want to raise $2 million to renovate the new building that we were in. Originally, the YWCA in Gary in 1920 started out in a building at 6 East Avenue in Gary, which was 6th in Massachusetts at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that building got kind of ran down, so they built a new building in 2000, which is where we are now at 150 West 15th Avenue. And so this building is 20 years old. It needs some renovations. And we want to raise enough money to get those renovations done in this building. So that's why we're doing the fundraisers and everything else we can do. And with the support from our community partners, we want to be able to raise enough money to renovate the building we have here today.
Is there been any plans in the future, at least, for any expansion of the facility? Or for right now, at least, pretty content with just doing some improvements into the building?
Well, right now we want to do we want to get the building back to the way it was before, and we are thinking about future expansions. Yes, we mm-hmm. are. But right now we just want to get everything back up to code because, it's 20 years old and, with everything that's 20 years old, it's time to renovate. So that's our main goal at this time.
Now, Karen, what kind of reaction have you gotten from folks in Gary and all of Lake County, for that matter, about the 100th anniversary for the YWCA coming up?
It's really been great. A lot of people cannot believe we're 100 years old because that's just one of those numbers in people's minds that is just so far fetched. But, we're really, really excited to be 100 years old. And I like to tell people, you don't get to be 100 just by osmosis. You have to really work at it. And so we're really proud and excited. And we've been getting pretty good support. And we're just, from people all over. And being that it's a virtual world now and everything is Zoom, we're getting support from all over the country, from people who at one point lived in this area and who were members of the Y teens and things like that from years ago.
Once again, the 100th anniversary celebration for the YWCA of Northwest Indiana, which started out in Gary and still based in Gary, is happening on Halloween Day on October 31st. It's going to be a live streaming event from the Majestic Star Casino Pavilion. And if anybody's interested in more information about the big gala coming up, Karen, how can they find out?
they may go to our website, which is www.ywcanwi.org, or they can call at 219-881-9922.
Karen Jones is Executive Director of the YWCA here in Northwest Indiana. Karen, thanks for being with us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Chris.
In the second part of our series on young activists, we feature Dina Martinez. She's an IUPUI student, and during her childhood in the Honduras, she faced serious health issues and realized the importance of government and being involved in your community.
My name is Dina Martinez. I am 23 years old, and I live in Indianapolis. At the age of 7, I was sent to live in Honduras, which is my family's native country. In Honduras was when I realized how privileged and how lucky I was to live in the United States. There were days that I would go hungry. There were days that I was very sick because I was anemic and I had a lot of health issues. The quality of water is very different. And you realize that the role of government and being involved in your community, how important that is very, very young. Halfway through high school was when I started getting involved in politics. And that is more of the advocacy side of civic engagement, which I absolutely loved. I helped with the Scott Fadness campaign in Fishers. I was a sophomore, junior in high school. And I was like, okay, I'm going to stand outside the polls and I'm going to give people these little pieces of literature so that they can vote for you. I had no idea who this man was, or I didn't know what party he was, but I knew that it was important to go vote. Once I went to college, I became president of IUPUI's inaugural Women for Change student chapter. And that was really crazy because it was after the 2016 election. I remember there was a student engagement series there for the State of Women. And there was this group of ladies like telling us that at the end of the day, it's important that you know that you have rights and that your voices are important. And one of them looked me directly in the eye and like, I perceived it that way. And she's like, it's your time to take up the mantle. That really impacted me. I've been blessed ever since that I've been able to advocate for young women all across my campus and in the state of Indiana, pushing for consent legislation. On the national level, I've been advocating for Latinos to be involved not only politically, but to run for office. Because even though I've seen people that look like me now, like physically, my culture hasn't been represented, especially in the state of Indiana. One of the greatest things that my family ever did for me was making me go to the polls with them at a very young age. I remember sitting down with my family and watching the debates. Did I know exactly what was happening in them or what foreign policy meant or like what our economy was doing in 2008? Absolutely not. I had no idea. It allowed me the opportunity to be educated and to know exactly how our government works. I think a lot of people focus on just the presidency, on that executive, but they don't realize that the legislative branch is so much more important, and especially in your state and local level. That has taught me that even though it's great to be involved in this, like the small microcosm of our communities, at the end of the day, anything that has to do with legislation still affects us, right? So it's important to have our voices out there. Democracy, it's not just the people in power, but it's the people that are being led. But it is a form of government in which all of our voices matter. You just have to be involved. And I think that's what makes it so beautiful, is that your voice counts. Maybe you don't win. It's not all about winning, but it's definitely about making a difference.
That's Dina Martinez, and part 3 in the series comes up tomorrow here on Regionally Speaking. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
It's difficult to be poor in the USA. When you go into an apartment complex and you ask for income-based housing, you're automatically put into a category. You're automatically separated from the rest of society. They treat you differently. Even to get an application is difficult. But when you get the application and you sit down to try to write it out, there's no one to help you. My niece is has special needs, and her husband went to the Portage Township because they were being evicted from their apartment. They went for help, and they didn't get any help because they didn't understand how to fill out the application. No one offered to help them. They were sitting there struggling and finally just gave up. I look at the example of housing opportunities when I filled out my application for housing. They were kind, respectful, honest, and compassionate. When I filled out my application for the food pantry in Portage, she wanted to know why, you know, why my daughter didn't have a job, why I didn't have a job. You know, it wasn't enough just to answer the questions. I almost felt like we were being interrogated about our decisions in life. It was kind of a very humiliating situation because Portage does have a really nice food pantry and you get some really nice things. But it was being abused by people who didn't really live in the area. Or just lying on their applications. And so because of that, now we have to go to the Portage Township and we have to get a waiver. So my daughter and I went to the Portage Township. And because my daughter is in school full time and she's not working, the lady who took our application just didn't understand that. She made us feel very low. It made me kind of angry afterwards in the car. I'm like, I don't want to go to that person and ask for help because they help you, but they do it begrudgingly. Poor people are looked down upon so badly that we're just trash and that we've done something bad in our lives or we're bad people because we've ended up in a certain situation. Well, guess what? There's a lot of people living paycheck to paycheck. I let myself get knocked down sometimes, I do. But then I have to go to myself, my inner self, my inner strength. I have to almost take myself out of my situation and really look at it and ask myself, am I doing everything possible that I can to support myself and my children? Am I doing everything possible I can to advance my life? And I am. I'm doing everything I can. I'm not such a bad person. I just have some bad situations.
Gary was Gary because of U.S. Steel. Even when you were in high school, if you're old enough, you can get a summer job at U.S. Steel. Walked in the mill, would have been in 1968 when I hired in for weekend labor. I walked in and I was just in awe because we'd walk in, it was like a city. And there was all these cranes and everything, and they're hauling this stuff back and forth. Well, the siren went off, and I didn't know what, you know, I'm looking up. I was scared to death, so I hid behind this beam because I didn't know what was happening. And then I see they have these big magnets that would haul these big plates of steel and such. If you could picture big furnaces all in a row, and say like 14 furnaces or 12 furnaces in a big row, and if you could imagine like on a ship where the guys shovel in the coal, and well, that's how this was kind of like. An open hearth consists of, it's a steel making furnace. So they take hot metal, which they produce in the blast furnaces. They could take iron ore, they melt it down, they make pig iron and hot metal. They take it over to the open hearth and they charge this in open hearth furnace. And then they add all these other additives to make the steel. Back in that day, they said it was like making soup. It was like an 8-hour process. And they had these ladles, and they'd open up these portholes and then pour this molten steel out into the ladles. Guys would grow beards in the summertime because of the heat from the blast furnaces and from the open hearts being that close. I mean, they had guys working with this hot metal with no hard hats and things like that until the unions came in and things got a lot better, you know, safety-wise. I remember days where it could be 10 below zero outside and you could walk up to the open hearth furnace and you're 50 feet away from this thing and it's like summer. But you know, as soon as you walk away and then you're like freezing again. And then once you got seasoned to that, that was, you know, you just got accustomed to it. Like when you start out running, when you, you know, try to run a mile and you're half dead, you know, you get finally, it was on a daily basis, you got the hang of it, and it became second nature.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. For months, thousands of residents in Indiana nursing homes have been isolated. What began as an early pandemic protection is now eroding their quality of life. Despite forming an essential and compassionate caregiver program, the Indiana State Department of Health has deferred much of the oversight and management to the facilities themselves. Caregivers are caught in the middle, and they're often left powerless. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brock Turner looked into that.
Vicki Ayers fights back tears as she remembers her mom, Carolyn, who died just a month ago.
She loved to travel and eat out. And, you know, we would take her out several times a week for outings. And when they locked down, that was over.
Ayers' mother lived in a Delphi nursing home, just a short drive from her home in northern Indiana. When the pandemic began, Ayers says she considered moving her mom out of the facility, but she was concerned because there wasn't an accessible bathroom in her home.
I didn't feel like, at the time, that it was the best thing for her or for my family. I didn't feel like I was set up properly in my home to be able to have her here. 6 months later, knowing what I know now, do I wish I had done that? Yes. And just figured it out as I went along.
The situation quickly spiraled. Ayers says staff at St. Elizabeth Healthcare Campus kept her mom isolated in the facility's COVID-19 wing for weeks. That's even after she tested negative multiple times. According to Ayers, though, it gets worse. She says her mom and other residents went months without receiving proper showers, and staff restricted visits, even window visits from caregivers. Trilogy Health owns St. Elizabeth and is one of the largest nursing home operators in the Midwest. The company declined an interview and did not comment on the facility's policies, stating that it would be an invasion of resident privacy. Andrea Smothers is the ombudsman who oversees the area. She says nursing homes across Indiana have been forced to interpret vague guidance, and that's leading to significant variation in terms of visitation.
The guidance that they were given, pretty much from our perspective as advocates, gave a lot of control to those facilities on how or when or under what circumstances they would allow visitors.
That visitation guidance from the Indiana State Department of Health was updated to reflect the latest federal language. It outlines clearer procedures, but sets a high bar for indoor visitation. For example, facilities are advised to prohibit indoor visitation if there are active COVID-19 cases in a facility. But multiple ombudsmen who serve as advocates for caregivers and their loved ones say facilities are doing a poor job communicating these policies and updating caregivers on the changes.
And so those changes and that lack of communication, I think, build the distrust by the caregivers and that the facilities somehow have this power to just do whatever they want.
The Indiana State Department of Health declined an interview for this story, but provided a statement in part saying that they encouraged visitation in facilities. During the state's weekly COVID-19 press briefing, Dr. Lindsay Weaver, the chief medical officer for the Indiana State Department of Health, said caregivers can still file a complaint with ISDH if they feel a facility has wrongly denied their application to be an essential caregiver. Weaver says there's no evidence visitation has led to outbreaks, and that fuels anger among caregivers.
What we're doing is wrong, and it's wrong to an extent that I don't think most people are aware of. It is abuse. At this point, it is abuse because it is long-term. It isn't the short-term health crisis solution to the first month worth of the pandemic. We don't know how this is going to happen. Now, it's abuse.
And that's why Ayers and others say they're going to keep advocating for visitation.
They could make it work. And it's not that they can't, it's that they won't. And that's wrong. So even though my journey is over with my mom, I have to speak for those people that are left.
Despite being able to file complaints, the Indiana State Department of Health says it is up to facilities to decide who receives the essential caregiver designation. And it has no data on the number of applications accepted or denied. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brock Turner.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll join us tomorrow.